you know, could have become an opposition figure at some point in the future, and that was enough for Mohammed bin Salman to order his execution.
Al-Jabri's lawsuit reads, "The Tiger Squad defendants attempted to enter Canada covertly, traveling on tourist visas and seeking to avert the detection of Canadian border security by entering through separate kiosks." Observers say the attack on the exiled spy and his family is part of a bigger picture to muzzle the Crown Prince's critics at home and abroad. Al-Jabri was long an aide to Prince Mohammed bin Nayef, the former head of Saudi intelligence, who later became heir to the throne before being deposed and detained by bin Salman in 2017. Though loyal to his country, Al-Jabri has been in self-imposed exile since then, fearing for his life.
You know, the Saudi government has always been run by consensus, a consensus of the family. They have a family council, which is made up of hundreds of senior princes. And the family council is not even consulted anymore, not since Mohammed bin Salman took power. And when he took power, what did he do? He arrested the crown prince. He arrested the Minister of Interior. He arrested the head of the Saudi intelligence service, not because they were corrupt, as he said. I mean, the Saudi family is the definition of corruption. He arrested them because he was afraid that they could eventually depose him. And anybody who he believes could possibly, maybe, someday be a threat is either arrested, exiled, or killed.
On the other hand, the Saudi embassy in Washington has made the statement that Al-Jabri is a discredited former government official with a long history of fabricating and creating distractions to hide the financial crimes he committed. Accusations of this kind are nothing new, as over the past years, many Saudi officials have been arrested on charges of financial corruption. Critics say they are mostly trumped-up charges for political purposes. The most well-known case happened in early November 2017, where about 400 of Saudi Arabia's most powerful people, among them princes, tycoons, and ministers, were detained in the Ritz-Carlton Hotel. It proved to be the biggest and deepest purge in the modern kingdom's history.
These embezzlement and corruption charges against Saad al-Jabri and his children are made up. They're concocted. What the Saudis have done is to arrest the man's children in an attempt to force him back to the kingdom. And we all know that the moment that he were to land in Saudi Arabia, he would disappear, and no one would ever see him or hear from him ever again. So he's hoping that Western governments, especially Canada, where he is right now, and the United States, with which he's had a long and close relationship, can pressure the Saudi government to have his children released. They've done nothing wrong. Their only crime is to be his children.
Meanwhile, Hissa al-Muzaini, another daughter of al-Jabri, Saad al-Jabri, says Saudi officials were trying, as part of revenge against her father, to lure her into the kingdom's consulate in Istanbul, where Khashoggi was hacked into pieces. The saga of the Prince and the Sky is a telltale sign of what might be going on inside the kingdom. When an influential and loyal Saudi spy master and his family, who have close ties in Washington and the CIA, are not immune from the Saudi crown prince's whims and wrath, what might happen to Saudi dissidents inside the kingdom?
the limelight. Threats of violence have become commonplace among a significant part of the Republican Party in the United States, as historians and those who study democracy warn of a dark shift in American politics. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Lisa Lehrer and Astrid Herndon. The piece is titled, Menace Enters the Republican Mainstream. Threats of violence have become commonplace among a significant part of the Republican Party, as historians and those who study democracy warn of a dark shift in American politics. At a conservative rally in western Idaho last month, a young man stepped up to a microphone to ask when he could start killing Democrats. "When do we get to use the guns?" he said, as the audience applauded. "How many elections are they going to steal before we kill these people?" The local state representative, a Republican, later called it a fair question. In Ohio, the leading candidate in the Republican primary for Senate blasted out a video urging Republicans to resist the tyranny of a federal government that pushed them to wear face masks and take FDA-authorized vaccines. "When the Gestapo show up at your front door," the candidate, Josh Mandel, a grandson of a Holocaust survivor, said in the video in September, "you know what to do." And in Congress, violent threats against lawmakers are on track to double this year. Republicans who break party ranks and defy former President Donald J. Trump have come to expect insults, invective, and even death threats, often stoked by their own colleagues and conservative activists who have denounced them as traitors. From congressional offices to community meeting rooms, threats of violence are becoming commonplace among a significant segment of the Republican Party. 10 months after rioters attacked the United States Capitol on 6th of January, and after 4 years of a president who often spoke in violent terms about his adversaries, right-wing Republicans are talking more openly and frequently about the use of force as justifiable in opposition to those who dislodge them from power. In Washington, where decorum and civility are still given lip service, violent or threatening language still remains uncommon, if not unheard of, among lawmakers who spend a great deal of time in the same building. But among the most fervent conservatives who play an outsized role in primary contests and provide the Republican Party with its activist energy, the belief that the country is at a crossroads that could require armed confrontation is no longer limited to the fringe. Political violence has been part of the American story since the founding of the country, often entwined with racial politics and erupting in periods of great change. More than 70 brawls, duels, and other violent incidents embroiled members of Congress from 1830 to 1860 alone, and elements of the left have contributed to the confrontational tenor of the country's current politics, though Democratic leaders routinely condemn violence and violent imagery. But historians and those who study democracy say what has changed has been the embrace of violent speech by a sizable proportion of one party, including some of its loudest voices inside government and most influential voices outside of government. In effect, they warn the Republican Party in its mainstreaming menace as a political tool. Omar Wassel, a political scientist at Pomona College who studies protests and race, drew a contrast between the current climate and earlier periods of turbulence and strife, like the 1960s or the run-up to the Civil War. What's different about almost all those other events is that now there's a partisan divide around the legitimacy of our political system, he said. The elite endorsement of political violence from factions of the Republican Party is distinct for me from what we saw in the 1960s. Then you didn't have, from a president on down, politicians calling citizens to engage in violent resistance. From his earliest campaigning to the final moments of his presidency, Donald Trump's political image has incorporated the possibility of violence. Trump encouraged attendees at his rallies to knock the hell out of protesters, praised the lawmaker who body-slammed a reporter, and in a recent interview defended rioters who clamored to hang Mike Pence. Yet even with the former president largely out of the public eye, and after a deadly attack on the Capitol where rioters tried to overturn the presidential election, the Republican acceptance of violence has only spread. Opinion polls indicate that 30% of Republicans and 40% of people who most trust far-right news sources believe that true patriots may have to resort to violence to save the country, a statement that gets far less support among Democrats and among independents. Such views, routinely expressed in warlike or revolutionary terms, are often intertwined with white racial resentments and evangelical Christian religious fervor, two potent sources of fuel for the GOP during the Trump era, as the most animated Republican voters increasingly see themselves as participants in a struggle, if not a kind of holy war, to preserve their idea of American culture and their place in society. Notably, few Republican leaders have spoken out against violent language or violent behavior since 6th of January this year, suggesting with their silent acquiescence that doing so would put them at odds with a significant share of their party's voters. When the Idaho man asked about killing political opponents at an event hosted by the conservative activist Charlie Kirk, Mr. Kirk said he must denounce the question, but went on to discuss at what point political violence could be justified. In that vacuum, the coarsening of Republican messaging has continued. Representative Paul Gosar, Republican of Arizona, this week tweeted an anime video altered to show him killing Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and swinging two swords at Joe Biden. Lee Drutman, a senior fellow at the left-leaning group New America who has studied political violence, said there was a connection between such actions and the growing view among Americans that politics is a struggle between enemies. When you start dehumanizing political opponents, or really anybody, it becomes a lot easier to inflict violence on them, Dr. Drutman said. I have a hard time seeing how we have a peaceful 2024 election after everything that's happened now, he said. I don't see the rhetoric turning down. I don't see the conflict going away. I really do think it's hard to see how it gets better before it gets worse. Democrats are seeking Paul Gosar's censure, arguing that depictions of violence can foment actual violence and jeopardize the safety of elected officials. The ranking GOP lawmakers, Senator Mitch McConnell and Representative Kevin McCarthy, did not respond to repeated requests for comment. Kevin McCarthy, who initially condemned the 6th of January attack on the Capitol and said violence is never a legitimate form of protest, more recently has joked about hitting Nancy Pelosi in the head with a gavel if he were to replace her as Speaker of the House. Like nearly all of the members of his caucus, Kevin McCarthy has said nothing about Paul Gosar's video. For his part, Representative Paul Gosar, Republican of Arizona, has suggested that critics were overly thin-skinned, insisting that the video was an allegory of a debate over immigration policy. He was slaying the policy monster of open borders, not Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or Joe Biden, his office said. It is a symbolic cartoon. It is not real life. Carlos Curbelo, a Republican former congressman from Florida who is a critic of Donald Trump, said Republicans needed to take a stronger approach against violent language and intimidation tactics. I do think the problem is more acute among Republicans because there are a handful of Republican officials who have no limits, he said. Your country and your integrity should be more important to you than your re-election. The increasing violence of Republican speech has been accompanied by a willingness of GOP leaders to follow Donald Trump's lead and shrug off allegations of domestic violence that once would have been considered disqualifying for political candidates in either political party. Herschel Walker, the former professional football player running for Senate in Georgia, is accused of repeatedly threatening his former wife's life. But won Donald Trump's endorsement and appears to be consolidating party support behind his candidacy. Donald Trump also backed the Ohio congressional campaign of Max Miller, who faces allegations of violence from his former girlfriend, the former White House press secretary Stephanie Grisham. Max Miller has sued Stephanie Grisham for defamation. And Sean Parnell, a Senate candidate in Pennsylvania who was endorsed by Donald Trump, appeared in court this week in a custody fight in which his estranged wife accuses him of choking her and physically harming their children. Sean Parnell denies the charges.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the importance of work. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the importance of the work in the Islamic lifestyle. Generally, when we see the narrations of the Prophet and the verses of the Quran, it emphasizes and it prays those who work hard, who strive for the halal sustenance, who go out, they work hard, and then bring a halal sustenance for their households, for their children, for their family. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and the narrations as well from the prophets, it talks that this working is important. It is a worship. It explains us that working and bringing halal sustenance is an ibadah. It is the worshipping Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And on the other hand, it basically talks against being in the state of poverty. We should not become poor. The poverty is one of the punishments. Therefore, we should not go towards the poverty. Rather, having enough money to spend our life, not being at the level of poverty, this is something which Allah likes. And that's why He has given this power to us that we can earn. Our arms are basically, they're powerful so that we can work. We can see many people in their life, they strive for work, they never become lazy in their life, and that is because they are those who strive for sustenance, and Allah is also happy from them.
IRIB English Radio.
Our website is farstoday.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the importance of the work. I just remember a story from the Prophet ﷺ that when the Prophet was in his childhood, he never liked to be lazy. He never wanted to be in a state where he wasn't doing anything. And he always wanted to be busy in doing something. Therefore, we see that he asked his uncle Abu Talib to give his goats so that he can be the shepherd. And he took them out, and later he used to bring them back. Similarly, when he was a bit younger, he was busy in trading. He never had a time where he wasn't working. So therefore, the work itself is worshipping, and that's what we need to think. That's what we need to be careful when we talk about the Prophet, when we are talking about the work itself. So we need to be always working. Now, how can a work become worship? How someone who's working in the office, maybe is writing the checks, or maybe filling up the ledgers, or maybe counting the stock, how can this become a worshipping of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? This is definitely a worship of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala if it is in accordance to the teachings of Islam. Allah has said, do not strive for haram. If I'm not earning something which is haram, then yes, it is halal. And this is because of the orders of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So basically, I am obeying Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. When I'm obeying Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, then the works that I'm doing are the worship and praying, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Sky of wisdom.
the turn of the last century, spectacular advances in science and technology promised a bright future for mankind. A world brimming with comfort and happiness. People looked away from the heavens and started seeking felicity on Earth. The result was bewilderment. Little by little, people lost their confidence in man-made developments and began yearning for something that could re-establish their link to the sky, to bring them tranquility and peace of mind. Modern mysticism emerged as an answer to this desperate need, but soon turned out to be another false dawn, leaving man in more confusion and pain. But why have new spiritualities not been able to alleviate the pain of human suffering, and have even added to the confusion of human beings today? To find the answer to this question, it may be better to go to a real mystic who devoted his long life to finding truths. Far from the madding crowd and at the foot of Damovand Mountain was living a man with a sacred mission. A man who grieved a large number of his loved ones with his departure has left important mystical works behind, a valuable legacy for lovers of the path of salvation. His name was Allameh Hasanzadeh Amuli. The Allameh was born on February 10, 1929, in Ira, a quaint village in Armor, northern Iran. At six, he went to preschool and learned reading and writing. At age seven, he could easily read the Holy Quran in Arabic. A few days after he went to school, thanks to his high intelligence and diligence, he skipped grades and finished his school early. Taking his teacher's advice, he went to a seminary in Armor. He donned cleric attire as he finished the first seminary degree and then moved to Tehran, the capital city of Iran. One of his eminent teachers in Tehran was Mirza Abdul Hasan Shahrani. As a young religious student, Hasan learnt medicine, mathematics, and astronomy from his teacher. Shahrani, an eminent Muslim scholar of the time, wrote about his student, "Sheikh Hasan knows the Holy Quran inside out. He has an excellent command of the Arabic language. He also masters astronomy and mathematics, as well as religion and jurisprudence." By 1960, Sheikh Hasan was teaching in a seminary in Tehran. Before the 1963 demonstrations, which are regarded as the early sparks of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ruhollah Khomeini urged the clerics to incorporate in their Muharram speeches social and political issues and problems in the Muslim world, in particular Iran. It was then that the young cleric went to Qom to meet the grand Ayatollah, vow his allegiance to him, and promise to do what he had called for. The same year, he moved from Tehran to Qom. Upon his arrival, he started teaching religious courses as well as mathematics. At the same time, he attended for 17 years classes of Allameh Sayyid Muhammad Hussein Tabotabois, a distinguished Muslim philosopher and a great interpreter of the Holy Quran. He also went to classes of Sayyid Muhammad Hasan Ilahi Tabotabai, another outstanding Shia scholar. During 50 years of learning, teaching, and research, Ayatollah Hasanzadeh wrote 160 books in various fields. Hence, he was called Allameh, an honorary title given in Iran to people who are expert in various fields of study. Ayatollah Hasanzadeh published numerous books on jurisprudence, philosophy, morality, religion, mathematics, Persian and Arabic literature, natural sciences, occult sciences, and traditional medicine, but the majority of his work pivot around Islamic philosophy and mysticism, as well as the Holy Quran. What he addresses in his books is perhaps the answer to an important question that humanity is grappling with today. What is the way to live happily? And who is happy? Allama Hassanzade believed that since postmodern mysticism and modern spirituality are not bound by theism, they indoctrinate human beings with the idea that they can achieve spiritual vitality and peace with the help of his inner forces. Such mysticisms are purely materialistic by nature and completely ignore the evolutionary and ideal needs of human beings. Therefore, they would be disappointed and confused more than ever before. To the Ayatollah, Islamic philosophy, mysticism and religion are in complete harmony with one another. He mastered mysticism and philosophy at a time when the two subjects were strictly banned in religious seminaries. As a great Muslim philosopher, he deemed man as a creature coming from heaven to this world. His real self, as his soul and his body, just accompanies the soul in this world. He believed that man has many potentials needed to be realized before reaching perfection, and when he reaches the pinnacle of his existence, he will turn into a treasure trove of divine secrets. Mysticism, in its Islamic terminology, is the capacity and power of inner and heart cognition, by which the mystic achieves superior horizons of perfection in his relationship with God. Islamic mysticism is based on religion or Sharia. In other words, mysticism is the essence of the law that leads to the truth. If the mystic has reached any stage of perfection, there is a way for him to continue. Therefore, he must move, and the driving force of this movement is nothing but action, and the ruling and plan of this action can only be taken from religion. With no exaggeration, Allama Hassanzadeh can be dubbed as the reviver of Islamic philosophy and mysticism through educating a huge number of students and writing seminal books and articles over the course of several decades. His intense devotion to real mysticism that has its roots in the Holy Quran and the teachings of Prophet Muhammad and his infallible household, namely Shia Imams, was a serious attempt to prevent the younger generation from getting allured or deviated by emerging mysticism. The Allama firmly believed that without the Holy Quran, which is the words of God to guide human beings on earth, and the teachings of the Prophet and the Shia Imam, who were the real interpreters of the Holy Quran, mysticism would just misguide people, bringing them an eternal regret. Through his long life, Ayatollah Hassanzadeh promoted Shia mysticism, which is different in origin from other mystical schools. To him, these other schools originate from human beings themselves, and therefore are prone to mistakes and deviations. On the contrary, Shia mysticism stems from the divine source, coming down from heaven to help human beings find the right path up to their origin, to the utter world of divine love, towards God Himself. The Allama was of the opinion that this kind of mysticism is also compatible with the human intelligence and life in this world. On September 25th, 2021, at age 93, this great Shia theologian embarked on his journey to the next destination. In his message of condolence, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, wrote, "He was an all-round prominent scholar who infused his disciples with science, knowledge, and love. His works are great sources of erudition for wisdom seekers."
IRIB English Radio presents
Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion are two guest speakers, Sayyid Murtaza and Sayyid Mohsen. Sayyid Mohsen and Sayyid Murtaza, assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you very much for inviting me to this program.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
So today we want to talk about the 104th year in which marks the Balfour Declaration in Palestine. And, this Balfour Declaration, as the Palestinians calls it, has set the stage for the creation of the Israeli entity and the occupation of Palestine. Before getting to the issues that are taking place in Palestine today, let's get back to 1917, Sayyid Murtaza. Explain a little bit about the Balfour Declaration itself.
Oh, thank you very much. You know, this declaration actually prepared a base for occupation by imperial powers during First World War. And, you know, behind this was the Zionist, actually, powers that were present in European countries, specifically talking in Great Britain. We had that strong presence. And this declaration was actually made to prepare, I would like to add a terminology, and that terminology was actually introduced for the first time through this declaration. It was a national home. Mm-hmm. And this declaration was very much stating the fact that Jews and Jewish people actually needed a place for settlement.
That's right.
And this declaration, for the first time, introduced a terminology, a term, for a Jewish people in order to have a home in Middle East. So that national home was introduced through this declaration. Unfortunately, later, the same term was very much explained and described as a vague one, mm-hmm. because nobody knew about two parts of this declaration, national home. So because Jews were not very much the most bigger population in Palestine.
That's right.
So unfortunately, declaration was for the first time defined in a wrong way. And then based on that wrong definition, future developments were made.
So there was only Palestine at that time and there was no Israel, isn't it?
Of course, no.
As a result of this declaration, you know, a country by the name of Israel was established.
Well, actually, you know, there was a kind of strategic imperial, purpose and goal behind creating such a declaration. And Great Britain, especially the Zionist powers inside Great Britain, actually were behind this declaration.
Oh.
So it was actually made in order to benefit only Zionists and those who were actually following this political ideology. So there was no benefit to the Jewish people, in fact, and it was only forcing Jews to move to Palestine and create a man-made, actually, a system. And that was actually the Zionist regime. And we know there was no name as Israel land at that time.
Yes.
So a declaration was only a paper in the first place. Later on, based on the same wrong paper, there were more developments made.
Okay, Sayyid Mohsen, again, the role of Great Britain in establishing a legitimate authority in the Middle East, okay, we could see, you know, the power of the Britons in the other lands too. You know, they had their own ambassadors and embassies in different parts, also in Iran. They were active by supporting the Babis, you know, who wanted to create a kind of fake mysticism or power or something like that in Iran too. They were confronted, of course, by Amir Kabir on that time in Iran. But all in all, I could say that these colonial power had their role in establishing new lands because of their own purposes in the Middle East. What's your take on that, brother?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. When we talk about the British government or the UK, we should bear in our minds that this is the cleverest government or the establishment in the whole world because of their hypocrisy, because of their, you know, having two faces. And the main theme which they follow, through which they could rule over some parts of the world, including the Middle East and subcontinent. That theme, or we can say slogan, was divide and rule.
Mm-hmm.
So they try to divide the people of our place and then they rule over them. And that was the main reason of them having rulership over half of the world, we can say, or most of the countries. Now, this theme of divide and rule was applied on Palestinians as well. That's one side of the, that's one picture. We should look at the other side of a picture as well, that when we see the Holocaust happening and Hitler coming and killing all the Jews while saying that you will appraise me in future when you will know why I killed so many Jews, there was, we can say, like a harm or was a danger by the Jews to the existing, we can say, people or communities who were living in the Europe. Britain also never wanted to entertain Jews in their own country. You know, if Britain was at that time was thinking about the Jews and it wanted to give, you know, favor to the Jews, it should basically assign a specific land for the Jews.
That's right.
There is a big land over there. And if we can, we can see that they never did this, but rather what they did is they introduced this Balfour, we can say, like
declaration
in which the statement was initially, the statement was, if I can just read a couple of lines.
Okay.
It says, His Majesty government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people.
Mm-hmm.
Now there is nothing about Zionist regime.
Oh.
It's the establishment as a national home for the Jewish people. Now, the question is, since when we have a home on the basis or the grounds of the religions? Is UK a homeland for Christians, Muslims, Jews? What is it? We don't have anything. So why they did this? Obviously, it shows us that they want to divide and rule on the basis of the religions. And this is what they are pursuing. Until now, we can see what happened in the subcontinent, you know, the Qadiani. There is a religion which was made and supported by the British government. The Wahhabism, Abdul Wahhab, he came up and he established his own government in the Hijaz in the name of Ali Saud, the Saudi tribe from the Najd. So we can see these things happening in the world, which was done by the British government.
The British and the British.
So it says that it was a national home for the Jewish people and will use their best endeavor to facilitate the achievement of this object, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in the Palestine, or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. The question is, when you made this declaration, today where are you? We can see the Zionist regime expanding their land.
Yes.
I would say these are the thugs who have occupied the land of Jews, Christians, and the Muslims in Palestine.
Yes, the Zionist regime.
The Zionist regime. I'm talking about the Zionist regime.
Yes.
Now, when in this declaration they say that they will not harm like the rights that they have, then why they are sleeping now?
Yes.
Why they are supporting them now? Why, when they're occupying the Palestinian lands and they're taking the lands and the homes, destroying the homes of the Palestinians at today's world, why they're not saying anything? Why they're silent on such an object? So it is clearly understood that the British government or the UK always, whenever they make a declaration, especially for the countries other than them, there is a specific benefit for them, and obviously they want to rule the world. They want to become the master of the whole world, and that's what they're pursuing for.
And we know that since then so many catastrophes took place in Palestine. You know, mass killing of the people and children are taking place over there. And this year, 104 years have passed the Balfour Declaration, and still the Palestinians are suffering. Is it any way to get back to that declaration, Said Morteza, and delete it from history? And then Palestinians look after the rights for the lands or not?
Well, let's look at the other side of this declaration. One side, my brother mentioned, it was actually based on religious facts or religious elements. But actually what is happening on the ground these days is not based or according to any religious principles.
Mm-hmm.
So the political principles and ideologies is taking place all about this declaration. Long before, this declaration was described as a vague one. And these days, people are trying to provide a kind of close description of what was written there. Unfortunately, those lines that my brother just read have been misinterpreted from the first day.
That's right.
So from the political point of view, there are four reasons that so far have been calculated, and these reasons have been circulated even among mass medias. So the first one was that the Jews were actually massacred and prosecuted inside Europe. So they wanted to free these people.
Mm-hmm.
And this was just an excuse for British government to provide a kind of a safe homeland for the
asylum.
Jews.
They
were looking actually for a protection for
That's
them.
Right.
So the second was actually controlling a very strong African country, and it was actually Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
So they wanted actually to have a control over Egypt and Suez Canal. So they had the idea to control, to go and occupy Palestine in order to achieve that goal.
Okay.
The third reason was actually a kind of a strong lobby among British powerful figures and the Jews. When I say Jews, I don't mean actually the Jewish people, the Zionists, those who were actually the masterminds of creating such an ideology. And the third one actually was creating a government
this
as a puppet
the third one.
That was the fourth. That was the
third one. Okay.
And the fourth one was actually creating a kind of puppet regime in the region in order to have the upper hand and control the countries in Middle East. So as you can see now, Palestine has been used by all superpower countries and is just, you know, creating some kind of problems for the neighboring countries around Palestine.
Right.
So we can see the political aspect was much more stronger than the religious.
Than the religious
one. So I think that was a very strong reason. But if we go back and we plan to have something as a substitution or eradicate this declaration, so we have to go back and see the basics and the base for preparing such a declaration.
That's right.
Unfortunately, it happened around more than 104 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, most Middle East countries were some kind, you know, occupied by these imperial powers. And most Muslim countries were very much involved with their personal, you know,
That's
conflicts.
Right. Okay.
And I don't think we can go and create a kind of resistance to this declaration.
Mm-hmm.
But we have to go deeper and deeper into the layer of history and find some factors, influential factors that could have been actually used as a actually protection against issuing such a declaration.
That's all right.
By the points which brother just mentioned, four points.
Yes.
We can just take a result out of it that the Zionist regime are the servants of the British government.
This is so.
Who are working on the agenda of the, you know, British government in order to.
So who is Balfour? Alfred Balfour was a British ambassador, isn't it?
Yes,
it was. It was
Whereas when they think like they have a they have a country for their own, like it is not the case. Basically, the America and the British is nowadays using them, and obviously they are the, you know, puppets.
But the question is, why the international community is silent about, I mean, the crime of stealing Palestinian land?
Well, that's because of the system that we have in the world. For example, the capitalism is all over the world. And this system, obviously, it only talks about the investors and their benefit. The politicians who come, obviously, they also need some kind of, you know, investment.
That's right.
And they're also, we can say, like imprisoned under the system of the capitalism. Now, under the system, in the system of capitalism, we can see there were, you know, protests where it was 99% against one person. What was that? All those things. So most of these investors and those who have the companies who are running the politicians with their own money, most of them are the Jews.
That's right.
And they're related to the Zionist regime.
Of course, there are still some Jews who criticize the Balfour Declaration, too.
Yeah,
you
but
know?
These Jews are not the Zionists.
Zionist ones. That's we have to distinguish between the Jews.
We do
and
this.
The
that's
Zionists.
What I said. Like the Zionist regime is basically doing that. So the main issue is why the most of the politicians' countries
that's
we
right.
have the UNO, why they don't talk about it. It's because the finance is being provided by most of the Zionist regime, and obviously they are backing the governments. We can see clearly when there is a discussion in the parliament of, we can say, like the America or UK, They have these representatives over there,
yes,
who are representing.
Yes.
And obviously, because
they held their own conference,
it's
in the
because
US, like,
the system is corrupted.
Oh.
So until this system of this system is not being changed, until that time, obviously, they are in the power.
That's all right.
Let's look at the issue profoundly, and we will find some really understandable reasons that why Palestine has been named as the occupied land.
Mm-hmm.
We had these occupiers moving all the way from Europe to Middle East and occupying this holy land.
That's right.
So for one very simple reasons, nothing happens unless you have somebody in power in the system.
That's right.
So there was a very strong lobbying group inside the British government, and they were actually lobbying with other communities in the British government because they themselves were believing in the Zionist ideology.
That's right.
So these people, these strong figures in the British government, made this declaration to be identified in the first place, to be interpreted differently, and they put this declaration into practice by themselves.
That's right.
So they brought these Jews just to the Holy Land in order to give them a kind of settlement.
Mm-hmm.
But that was not actually the whole story. The bigger picture was a different one. They wanted to create a regime based on their own benefits.
Yes.
And they did this at the price of other nations.
That's right.
So they, now the occupied land is, the Palestine is the only land that does not belong only to Jews.
Yes.
We have Christians, Muslims, and even other nations.
Yes.
So Zionist regime is the one that has been brought by these imperials at that time. So I don't think Israel is going to stay there for long.
That's
and their presence is not going to last long.
Inshallah, inshallah, hope. And the Palestine will be free one day, inshallah. And Palestine is for Palestinians. Thank you very much, Said Mohsen and Said Murtaza, for presence in the program Viewpoints, talking about Balfour Declaration. It was very kind of you. And thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page. Also, a YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Fraction and call it solution. Don't give me a prison and call it a
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 41 meters, 7300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.